Hi, and welcome back to another episode of Unmasking Autism with AFO. I have another, as always, really great guest for you today, and that is Lindsay. I don't want to mess up your last name because it's hard to pronounce. Sorry.
That's okay. It's Lindsay Vandeventer.
Okay, that's what I thought. But yeah, welcome. Thank you for being here. Would you like to tell everyone a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for having me. I'm really glad to be here, really grateful. So Lindsay Vandeventer, licensed clinical social worker. I was born and raised in Oklahoma and lived here all my life. I didn't know that I was autistic until 3.5 years ago. I'm 41 now, and I've been in the mental health field, both clinical and non-clinical mental health work, for 21 years. So it kind of blew my mind when I figured out that I was autistic and didn't know it, also ADHD. But currently I specialize in the treatment of complex PTSD and neurodivergence. The vast majority of my therapy and coaching clients fall under those categories, and I'm really passionate about mental health and neurodivergence, particularly since, as you know, we tend to deal with an incredible amount of chronic suicidal ideation, suicidal thoughts, and also suicide completion, which I think just speaks to the level of need for support and education. So yeah, that's a little bit about me. I'm really glad to be here.
No, yeah, I'm really glad to have you here. And for those who don't know, who, and I will put your info in the description of the episode, but you can find Lindsay online at The Autistic Therapist. And so just a brief little how we sort of met was interacting online and then met in person at that social in Tulsa. Mm-hmm. And now you've been a great resource for AFO, and you've come out and, you know, shared your expertise with people in the community. And I think it's really important for autistic people to be able to gain access to and recognize that there are mental health professionals out there that are also autistic, ADHD, neurodivergent. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just really excited to talk to you because you are all those things. And that's what this whole podcast is about. So you briefly mentioned it, but you do specialize in the treatment of PTSD, trauma, and disassociation. Mm-hmm. Can you give people just a little examples of what these diagnoses are and how you can discuss some treatment options for each?
Yes. So I'm going to choose to specifically talk about complex PTSD and dissociation with regard to neurodivergent people. So it's interesting because now that I work primarily with neurodivergent people who also have complex trauma, what I have observed anecdotally is that clients, whether they have had, you know, let's say it's a client that grew up with good enough parents, meaning they have pretty secure attachment, they don't have a lot of adverse childhood experiences or traumas, those individuals still seem to present with clinically relevant symptoms or traits commonly associated with folks that have complex PTSD. And if you know what complex PTSD is and means, you can appreciate how significant that is when you think about folks that have CPTSD that did have a lot of adverse childhood experiences, which is commonly the association there, versus those who have had little of those and maybe did have a supportive family, but still ended up with the same struggles. It is an interesting observation, and I have since learned from my own lived experience, but also through connecting with others in the community, that many of us experience like Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, hypermobility spectrum disorders, which chronic pain, postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, which directly negatively affects the autonomic nervous system. So like our respirations, our automatic vital functions. So then the body flips into fight or flight mode, right? Or freeze or people please mode. So suffice it to say that like our nervous systems are exponentially more sensitive than autistic people, and so we are much more likely to be susceptible to, for our body mind and our spirit to interpret stressful life events or ongoing stressors as traumatic, right? And that makes so much sense to me and my own lived experience. I wish I would have known that like 20 years ago. So with that, there are a number of treatment modalities that are available for trauma. And one of the things I think that we need to be aware of is that a lot of times neurodivergent people, from a clinical standpoint, and I try to educate my colleagues about this. I recently did a continuing education course at the community mental health nonprofit that I work for to educate other providers about autism level one, how to identify that, and how to make some considerations and accommodations for your clients, because the treatments that are available, like cognitive behavioral therapy, EMDR, which is eye movement, EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. The framework of that was initially based upon autistic people, but we know that there are some autistic people that think in pictures, and there are some autistic people that cannot visualize.
Yeah.
So some of those interventions, if a clinician doesn't know that about their client, and many times we as neurodivergent people don't necessarily know that about ourselves because that's our normal, right? So we don't know. Like when I realized that I was autistic, I was like, there are people in the world that don't have an inner monologue all the time,
Yeah.
right? Some autistic people don't have an inner monologue, some of us do, but I don't know, like there's different things that you have to consider. So I think that if you're gonna be getting trauma treatment, it's good to kind of do a little bit of research to find out, what your clinician knows about neurodivergence and see how they might be able to accommodate you. I think that's particularly important because, going to therapy is hard for a lot of people for a lot of reasons. And working on trauma in any way, whether it's self-healing work or supplemented by therapy or mental health, isn't easy, and it takes courage and vulnerability. So if you're gonna bother going through the process, it's helpful to know that there are certain things you might want to consider. By and large, EMDR is known to be, you can quickly peruse it on Google Scholar, but EMDR is largely the most well-researched and documented treatment for PTSD.
Now that's the one where like you follow a light, right? And you move your eyes in a certain way. Okay.
Yeah, it actually can be done in different ways sensorially. So it can be like where the therapist moves their hand like this and the client would watch,
Okay.
Their eyes would go back and forth. Eye movement is in the title of the treatment, but actually it's simply the bilateral stimulation of the body in whatever sensory form it comes.
Okay.
So I find that some clients prefer auditory. Like I could click a pen back and
Okay.
forth at the same repetition per minute, and that would produce a similar effect. Or for people that are proprioceptive sensory seekers, that like weighted blankets and stuff, predictably I've noticed that they might respond better to me tapping on their knees.
Okay.
I also have some equipment where I work where there's like a light bar. The client can choose what color, right,
Okay.
that they prefer. And also there's these like buzzers that you can hold in your hand or put in your pockets that vibrate like a game controller or a phone for
Okay.
tactile. So there's a lot of different ways that you can achieve that same accessing of the brain and the nervous system. But that's what's really cool about EMDR is that it's actually not a talk therapy, right? So it's a neurological intervention, and it's really powerful because it allows people to be able to process and heal trauma without necessarily having to talk about it at all. And you can imagine how useful that would be for, mm-hmm. for folks that have been through traumatic events that really would rather not verbalize it or can't, or that it would just be too triggering.
Yeah.
You know? So I really love that. And I also love that EMDR can be used for self-healing work. Like, you can use EMDR for yourself in between sessions,
okay.
to anchor in positive beliefs or affirmations.
Okay.
And it, the difference is, like, with EMDR, you know, when we're making changes in our lives, we can tell ourselves intellectually, cognitively, all day long, that we believe something different or we want things to be different. And we can really resonate with it, but we don't necessarily feel it in our bones, mm-hmm. so to speak. EMDR creates an opportunity for you to help the nervous system feel that to be true in your bones,
okay.
so to speak. And I think that that is one of the things that's really beautiful about it.
Okay, yeah. I myself have not ever done that, but it does sound interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to ask a question. Going back to the CPTSD.
Can I add something?
Oh, yes, sorry, of course. Nope, go for it. Nope.
Another thing I thought would be relevant is, like, as I'm sure many of you know, fellow autists and ADHDers, there are a number of different experiences that we have, right? Like OCD, mm-hmm. Eating disorders or disordered patterns with food. Those things can also be targeted effectively with EMDR.
Okay.
And there's research around that too.
Okay, cool.
So it's multimodal.
Okay. Okay. I still very much need work in my obsessive compulsive thinking.
Mm-hmm.
But that's for another day. No, but thank you for sharing that, because I myself did not really know anything about it until you had said that you did it, and then I looked it up, and so thank you for explaining what that is. So I want to, the CPTSD thing. So you were talking about how autistic people who didn't, you know, necessarily have bad childhoods can still have complex post-traumatic stress disorder. And I would like to talk about this more so just to maybe reaffirm bullying, for example. Bullying is trauma, right? Like, so, you know, because I have met some people throughout my adulthood where they, like you're saying, they come from great families and they have all the support, you know, they could ever have needed and wanted, but yet they don't think that they have any issues, because a lot of people think, well, if my family home was good when I was a child, then I'm fine. But like myself, for example, I know that probably all of my trauma stems from being bullied.
Yeah.
So it wasn't necessarily coming from my home, but it was happening to me every single time I left the house. So that's mm-hmm. still traumatic, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. I think that especially at this stage of our like societal progression, or socio-political environment, I think that now more than ever, right, like bullying is absolutely a traumatic event, and it is often repetitive, right? And so that's what the difference is between CPTSD and regular PTSD. Complex PTSD creates a different set of symptoms and traits within someone and their nervous system functioning, because the traumatic stressor is unavoidable and occurs frequently, right? And along those lines too, I wanted to fold in another point that I think is important for us to understand about ourselves and each other. With CPTSD, you know, when we can't avoid the stressor, maybe we don't know that we're kids, and we don't know that we're neurodivergent. Our parents don't know. And so we're not even able to meet our sensory needs that help us to regulate our nervous system, to find our calm. So we're like walking around in a constantly heightened state of activation in our nervous system of like fight or flight. What happens is in the nervous system, when fight and flight don't work because the stressor is inescapable, our nervous system then shifts down to people please or freeze. So in that vein, we see dissociation. And dissociation is where you feel pretty checked out from your environment. You feel like your head's kind of in the clouds, you're on autopilot. You may feel a really dampened sense of your emotions, not really feeling in touch with your body. And that dissociation piece is a whole nother set of challenges in addition to the other PTSD symptoms that so many neurodivergent people I've noticed experience higher levels of dissociation. Because a lot of what we experience is inescapable stressor.
Yes. And now disassociation can also lead to depersonalization, right?
And derealization.
Yes. Yeah. And that's those moments when you sort of feel like life just isn't real, right?
Yeah.
What, in your professional opinion, like, what is something that somebody could do? And yes, I'm sort of asking for myself, like, when those moments happen, like, what is something that someone actively can try to do to come back to reality, for lack of a better term?
Well, that's an excellent question. And that's been something that I've had a real deep dive into in the pandemic era, because my own nervous system just, like, I experienced burnout, and that's when I realized I was autistic. And interestingly, in a spiritual way, I feel, I kept having this thought of, like, whatever is wrong with you, whatever the fuck is going on, I'm sorry, I don't know if I'm supposed to cuss or not.
Try not to, sorry, it's okay.
But whatever is going on, I need to figure it out, and it's about my nervous system. I have to learn how to regulate and deal with my nervous system. I mean, I knew some things about that as a therapist, but it was a dire thing. And I have since learned a lot more about how to regulate. Interestingly, our stimming behaviors are what that we are trying to regulate our nervous system so that we feel better, right? Like, we feel like we're in that rest and digest mode, cool, calm, and collected. So stim away, y'all. I fully encourage people to do that, because that's one way that you can take care of yourself, right? But when you're experiencing a moment of high dissociation with derealization or depersonalization, where, like, you don't really feel real, or you feel like you're walking around in a movie that isn't real, something that you can do is some somatic body-oriented strategies to help you ground or settle back into your body. So different things you might try are maybe like taking your shoes off and feeling, concentrating on the sensation of underneath your feet. Go outside, stand on the ground, literally grounding to the earth. Getting in touch with your breath. Sometimes deep breathing can be further activating or triggering for people. So if you're one of those people, don't worry about it. Focus on something else that's body oriented. Another thing that I really benefit from with dissociation, and a lot of my clients do, is a strategy of doing this.
Okay.
Like slaps all over the body, not like super hard or anything. But you'll notice when you do that, what do you notice about that sensation?
I can feel.
You feel like more alive, right?
Okay, yeah.
There's this, you can feel the sensation.
Yeah.
It's almost like after you go for a quick walk and you feel the blood, your circulation is going.
Yeah.
So it kind of wakes you up.
Okay.
And pulls you back into your body. Okay, here I am. I'm in this studio right now. I'm talking with you. And it, little things like that seem at first thought kind of dinky and silly, but actually they're not. It's very effective. As mammalian creatures, our nervous systems are still very much operating in a very primitive way. Mm-hmm. And we live in a world that gives us an onslaught of overwhelming sensory overwhelm and social overwhelm.
Yep.
So we have to use some of these strategies that seem a bit more primitive or body-oriented in order to accomplish some regulation, especially when our stems have been shamed out of us.
Yeah, no, yeah. I like that tapping thing. I'm not, you know, saying do this, but something I should probably do that instead of biting. Mm-hmm. I'll like bite my lip to the point where it like, you know, hurts, you know, just to like pull myself out of that. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. Is this a simulation? Is this a simulation? Which I'm not saying it is, but you know, just when you're disassociating, you know, I mean, really, like for people who do not know, like it sort of, you know, it can be very anxiety producing, you know, like all of a sudden you sort of realize that you're doing it and then it's, you know, you got to figure out a way to, like you said, like come back to center. And so thank you for sharing the tips. I like that a lot.
Another one that's quick and easy is cold exposure. So if you have some ice and you can hold it in your hand or put something cold like a water bottle on the back of your neck. Your vagus nerve is seated at the base of your head, at the top of your spine, and that stimulates the vagus nerve to help, you know, pull you and ground you back into your body in the present moment. Seems kind of counterintuitive, but it's actually really effective.
Okay, yeah. Cool. No, thank you so much. I want to talk about masking again for a second also. There's lots of research to back this up. You sort of touched on it. I've touched on it on the podcast before as well. Masking is so harmful to autistic people. Yeah. And yet it's something that we do because we have to, and because we're not fully living in a world, you know, autistic people are having to conform to mainstream society. And while we're definitely making strides for mainstream society to meet us halfway, it is still something that autistic people do that is negative to us. It harms us physically. It harms us mentally. Suicide is the second leading cause of death for autistic people with an intellectual disability and the first for those without. And the more I research and become introspective about masking, the more I realize how like, wow, it really is dangerous to us. So as a professional, can you speak a little bit about why you think masking is what it is, and how can some autistic people who are struggling with unmasking, how can they maybe get better at that?
That's such a good question and a really important topic for sure. And I think that the very harmful impact but also necessary nature for survival that masking has is complex, and we want to reduce our masking as much as we can, but that also is contingent upon a number of factors which may very much be beyond our control, right? Like if we happen to be a person who's Black, Brown, or Indigenous, we may have to mask more by necessity and not feel that we can unmask as much. If we are a GLBTQ or two-spirit person, we might experience that too. And a lot of us have like intersecting forms of oppression that we live with in addition to being neurodivergent. Mm-hmm. So that's something just to consider. You know, I understand the struggle is real, and I certainly am a high masking person, and I'm learning to try to unmask more and more. There is definitely some intersection between masking and dissociation, and for autistic level one folks, in other words, folks with relatively lower support needs, I just don't like functioning labels, but that's the best term I can come up with for now. It's really a misnomer in a lot of ways because even if we are able to be high achievers in certain aspects of our life, I think with masking especially, people don't see the very real struggles that we experience. And I think that it leads to a sense of isolation and self-hatred that is very real. And one of the best things that ever happened to me was learning that I was autistic, because for once in my life, I was aware that some of these things I struggle with, many of these things I struggle with, are not necessarily my trauma. Like, I was wired this way, y'all. Mm-hmm. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Does that mean I can quit beating myself up so much? Yes, it does. And it's changed things for me greatly. And I find that it changes things a lot for people when we realize that a lot of the things that we beat up on ourselves for, and that other people beat up on us for, are directly related to the genetic phenotype that we live with. Mm-hmm. So anyhow, masking is really, it's a necessary evil, and reducing it is important. There's a relationship between it and dissociation. And some clinicians would say, you know, a lot of autism level one folks, for instance, experience what we would clinically call a diffuse sense of self. In other words, we can be very much chameleon-like and therefore not really have a solid sense of who we really are underneath the mask.
My daily struggle.
Right? And so then we end up having these, like, there's a big difference, okay, y'all, there is actually a big difference between, like, OSDD and DID, which would be dissociative identity disorder, and a related co-condition called OSDD. So it's not to that extent per se for a lot of folks. Some folks may just feel like a social chameleon by necessity and then never really have had the opportunity to really self-reflect and find out who you are underneath the mask. So I think that it does also impact issues of identity, which can then lead to more sense of social isolation, right? Because if you don't feel like you know who you are, then how do you know who your people are, right? But also, another thing of interest, which applies to my client population that I serve, is that there is actually quite a bit of overlap, a lot of co-occurrence between the form of neurodivergence that is DID, or dissociative identity disorder, and co-occurring autism and ADHD. I have also found this to be true about other forms of neurodivergence, and that many of us have overlap.
Okay.
So not just with autism and ADHD, but of course OCD, Tourette's, even like narcissistic personality disorder, borderline personality disorder, ASPD. Those are all very, very different things, right? But there is often a lot of overlap because they go back to not a mental health disorder in and of itself, despite how it's categorized currently, mm-hmm. And not a disease medically, but a genetically heritable phenotype difference. That is what neurodivergence is. I don't know why it's difficult for people to integrate that into the working awareness in our society, but I think it's really something we all need to be more aware of.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, I think, and I will get lost on a tangent if we talk about this, but I completely agree with you, and, you know, thank gosh for people like you and organizations like AFO and all of the other great people that are, you know, dedicating our lives to doing this type of work, because it really is just so needed. And I have very complex feelings about the rise of popularity on TikTok. But yes, I'm just gonna stop myself there. You touched on COVID, so let's circle back around to there also. In the first year of the COVID-19 pandemic, the global prevalence of anxiety and depression increased by a massive 25%, according to the World Health Organization. Did you see this type of increase in mental health conditions in your practice? Has this improved, or are you still seeing the effects of the pandemic in your clients?
Yes and yes is the short answer. Interestingly, when the pandemic broke loose, I was actually doing infant and early childhood mental health which involves a lot of trauma therapy, actually, but in a different context than with older people. So I was working with littles, like 0 to 4, and their caregivers. Okay. At an early Head Start school. I was embedded there. These were families that are already dealing with being historically marginalized, dealing with poverty, domestic violence, all kinds of issues, food desert. And when the pandemic hit, that was so clear in the client population that I was working with. Caregivers and families were horribly affected, which then in turn had an effect on the kids. And then the kids would have to be taken away from their regular routine and sequestered from social connection. And there was just a really big impact for sure. In fact, I don't think that people understand how difficult it was to be a therapist during that time. I know that there was a lot of talk about what that must have been like for doctors and nurses, and absolutely, I know that that mm-hmm. was traumatically stressful for them. But I would say that it also has been really traumatically stressful for mental health professionals, and that's not something I hear people talking about.
Yeah, no, I have not heard that.
Because essentially, you're having to steward someone else's trauma and hold safe relational space for someone who is completely unhinged by everything that's going on, dealing with all the stuff they had going on beforehand, the pandemic and all the stuff with it. And then you yourself are also right there with them, right? Mm-hmm. And so that seems to be a theme ever since the beginning of the pandemic.
Yeah.
Because of all of the other socio-political upheaval that's been going on since then. The economy, all that stuff. It's a lot to hold for people seeking services and for professionals. The moral of that story is that we all need to be good to each other mm-hmm. because we're living through really challenging times. As far as how it's impacting people now and how I see it in my current client population, I've noticed that, like me, I think a lot of neurodivergent people, I'm noticing just anecdotally. I don't know if there's been research on that yet, but it seems to me that there was just a big rise in particularly people that were late identified,
yeah.
right? Realizing that they're neurodivergent later in life during the earlier part of the pandemic. I don't know if some of that had to do with like more access to the internet and spending more time inside on the internet and or just this all of those stressors just creating a breaking point in burnout for a mm-hmm. lot of people. But burnout has been a topic of discussion for a lot of people seeking treatment lately, whether they're neurodivergent or not. I think it's doubly so for neurodivergent people. But even autistic people are experiencing levels of burnout that seem to be different than what we talked about prior to the pandemic.
Okay, that's very interesting. Yeah. Wow.
Like as a baseline, like people are just talking about burnout regardless,
okay.
you know, and I think that's really interesting because before you would hear people in the clinical world talk about burnout in the context of like professional burnout or, well, professional burnout
yeah.
primarily, right?
No, absolutely. Yeah.
But we're talking about burnout all around in all domains of life where you're just like, okay, I'm going to sit in this recliner and stare at the wall because that's all I can do right now mm-hmm. for days on end.
Yeah.
And that's real. And I think people are still contending with the impact of that. And I think the truth is, as far as I've been able to tell in my own life and with my clients, and in the listening of others' experiences on the, you know, national and international neurodivergent community, it seems like burnout is just not something that just goes away on its own.
Yeah.
Like you really do need some extra information or support or community to help you move through that, to help your nervous system regenerate and repair, find some new ways to care for yourself and your nervous system. Because it's rough.
No, it is. And that brings me to another topic is, you know, what are some ways that you help yourself through burnout and show yourself wellness? And then what are some examples for people who, you know, may not have like certain access to things? Like for me personally, stand-up comedy is a way that I combat feeling burnt out, feeling depressed, anxious, suicidal. Stand-up comedy is just a way for me to express myself, and I feel better after I do it. Also, horses.
Yes,
I get around a horse and I'm like, I feel happy, happy, happy.
Yeah.
So I touch them weekly. I ride, I go to lessons and I ride and I take care of them. It brings me an extreme amount of dopamine and serotonin. And so those are two things that I consciously make sure I always have around in my life to offset all of those other things that are always also trying to bust into the forefront of my mind. So, what about you personally? I want to hear about you and then some things for people listening.
So for me, it's funny, like in the midst of my own autistic ADHD burnout earlier in the pandemic, I actually had switched my job from doing early Head Start, infant, early childhood mental health stuff to being a child victim advocate and trauma therapist at a family justice center where people go when you need like a protective order or kids being trafficked, like heavy stuff, right?
Okay.
And it wasn't the clients that was so hard, it was the systemic stuff that was really hard, right? And so I hit a brick wall in my burnout and I cashed out my 401k and I actually ended up laid off, which was a blessing at the time. And I took like 6 months off, and I'm a single parent of an also autistic child. So I just focused on parenting and spent my days trying to regenerate myself. And during that time, I had actually an opportunity to learn how to fly fish.
Okay.
Which is really interesting because when you're fly fishing in a river, you're doing this motion all day and your eye is watching the fly go down the river, and then you cast it again.
Okay.
And that was EMDR.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
I didn't realize that I was EMDRing myself.
Okay.
So I was noticing that I could be out there and for just hours and hours and just really feel regenerated, energized, peaceful, calm, and like I could get tasks done again.
Mm-hmm. We're having technical difficulties, sorry.
Oh, that's okay.
No, it's okay, keep talking.
So I discovered that, and that was before I got trained in EMDR and everything, but
okay.
You couldn't keep me out of the river. I still have a lot of learning to do, and I'm looking for a new fly fishing mentor who won't mansplain things to me. this is because I'd like to get back out there and do that. I don't have access to horses, but I wish that I did because horses are incredible animals, but they also are just really wonderful for helping people to co-regulate.
Mm-hmm.
So when we talk about regulating our nervous systems, there's like regulating yourself and then there's co-regulation. So humans and animals have these things, or some animals have these things called mirror neurons, which are brain cells that whose purpose is to link up with another person or animal's calm nervous system.
Yeah.
So yeah, so connecting with animals. Also, a few of my clients have service dogs.
Yeah.
And I want a service dog, but it's a big commitment, so I'm not there yet. but nature time for me is really huge. And one of my focused interests is foraging and plant medicines, like herbs you can find that you can heal with. I like to identify plants and fungi. I'm really interested in mycology, so I like to go hiking a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I love spending time in the Ozark Mountains. So nature time is very healing and restorative for me, and I find that my nervous system just almost instantly chills out.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time in the pandemic, I also took up hammocking.
Like, okay, yeah.
I have like three hammocks in my car at all times.
Okay.
so that if I find a good spot on a nice day to like put my hammock up in some trees, I will.
I've got one in my trunk,
Hammock, it's so good for your nervous system. In fact, my partner and I began dating during that part of the pandemic, and after our first date, I was like, I told him, I just figured out that I'm autistic and I'm going to try really hard not to mask and I'm just going to just do what I do. So if I do things that are weird, you know why. And he was so cool with that. And like, he's actually late identified ADHD or himself and realized that as at the during all of that. But I was like, hey, do you want to go hammocking with me after we have dinner? So we went hammocking. It was great.
Yeah, no, yeah, it is great.
So I think for me, it's been like nature, it's been hammocking, learning, doing stims that incorporate bilateral movement of the body. So whether that's hammocking, like fly fishing, doing things at home, like listening to music and swaying back and forth. That bilateral movement of the body is really good for helping you to sort of process and release stuck trauma-ness that gets lodged in the body. And also some somatic experiencing strategies, kind of what we talked about with that, different things of that sort. I think another thing that's been really important for me is learning about my physiological health and how health conditions that autistic people often have can impact the nervous system and getting appropriate like supplements. A lot of us are deficient in vitamin D and B vitamins, B12. So that kind of thing has made a big difference for my nervous system function too. And I didn't even know I needed it.
No, I think that that's great. Yeah, man, now that you talked about hammocking, I want to hammock. You know, maybe this is one reason that hammocking is awesome now that we're like kind of discussing it. Like, I like the swaying, you know? Whether I'm like just I constantly sway or like move from foot to foot. I'm wondering now if that's just me subconsciously trying to keep in bilateral movement. But no, yeah, so
Also, laughter is a really great anecdote to the true absurdity of the heaviness of all that exists. And I think in times like what we're living through right now, sometimes we might feel guilty about indulging in joy and laughter, but I would challenge that thinking, and I would say that getting in touch with our joy is a beautiful way to care for ourselves and is perhaps an act of resistance against things that are beyond our control that feel really gross.
I really like that statement. That's a really that's I really like
So
that.
laugh it up, y'all.
Yeah, no, I agree. For someone who may be experiencing burnout and maybe at that spot where they're aware that they're burned out, but they just can't muster up that, because I'll speak personally, like when I'm in a depression, I'm aware, I know I should get up and go to the gym, or I should get up and pick my clothes up off the floor, but you just can't. So someone who's in that state of burnout where they're aware, they know, but they just can't, you know, get themselves to get up and do whatever it is, take that first step. What, if anything, would you say to a person like that to try and just help them take that very first step to, you know, countering the burnout?
Well, that's a good question. I think, like, when I was experiencing burnout, I certainly was experiencing something akin to depression, but I also have experienced an episode of major depression or two in my day or more. But I felt like it was different. I felt like that sort of shutdown experience that's prolonged felt certainly depressing, mm-hmm. but it wasn't the same. It was different, but just as bad, if not sometimes worse. And often there can be overlap, right? Because when we're in that shutdown place, it's like it is depressing because you're not functioning the way that you could or sometimes should. So I think the first thing is just to realize that those of us that are autistic or have other co-occurring neurodivergences or multiply neurodivergent or dealing with multiple stressors in life, I mean, I'm trying to think of how to say this differently because I'm really passionate about this. And I'm really passionate about the fact that we're living through really, really difficult times. Mm-hmm. And so on multiple levels.
Oh, yeah.
And I think we need to just know that it's okay to show up as we are where we're at. So if I start seeing a new client, for instance, and they are burnt out, crispy, and depressed and not functioning very well, I'm going to be open to offering a hybrid option for how they see me. You know, ask if you're looking for help, find out if you can be seen virtually at first, if that feels like a baby step that's more accessible for you. If you need to do therapy from bed, that's better than nothing. I think working up to increasing the demands and the tasks that you take on, that can come in time, but when you are really at a place where you are crawling barely and not even walking, it is completely understandable and appropriate for us to lower our demands and our tasks. And that also means that maybe we need to ask for help. And I know that that can be really difficult for us, and I know that that can trigger some of our rejection-sensitive dysphoria or shame spirals, but we need each other in community now more than ever. And it's okay to ask for help. We are interdependent beings by design. Yeah. We are not independent beings. We are meant to care for one another. So your accessibility needs are real and valid, and those needs change over time. When we're in burnout or we're in depression, we may need a heavier lifting on the help that we need. It's okay to need that help. And I think, I don't know, my granny, God rest her soul, told me, and she lived a really hard life and overcame a lot and was super resilient. And I was in my transitional age youth, like, you know, I don't know, 18, 19, struggling with depression and adulting. And she told me, baby, put your lipstick on and get dressed like you got somewhere to go, even if you're staying at home away from the world. And I was like, okay. But I knew that this is a woman had been through hell and back. So I thought, well, it's better than what I'm feeling now. So let me just try it. And as it turns out, there is something to that. So sometimes if we kind of push ourselves to go outside, get some fresh air, get some vitamin D from the sunshine, push ourselves to connect with a safe, relationally safe person in our life, push ourselves to take little baby steps, even if it's not the perfection that we have in our mind about the step we should be taking. I think also, speaking of shoulding, I don't know about y'all, but I have been known to do a lot of shoulding on myself. Like a hamster wheel that never ends of shooting all over. Well, I should be doing this. I should be doing that. I should this way or that way. Quiet the shooting. It's not about should. It's about survival. Mm-hmm. Once you start feeling like you're back into the groove a little bit more, slowly but surely, you can add on more of the shoulds. But shooting is not going to help you get out of depression or burnout.
You've shared a lot of really wonderful insights and perspectives today, and I just really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me and share your knowledge with everyone that will be listening. And if it's okay, I'll put your information in the description, so if any Oklahomans, you know, want to reach out. Is that okay?
Yeah, I think I would love that. And also, if there are entities throughout Oklahoma that want to know more about mental health and autism, or other professional providers that want to learn more, I'd be happy to pair up with AFO or anybody else, as long as I have the time and capacity to do so, to engage more on this topic. I think that it isn't talked about enough, and there's an awful lot of misunderstanding and ignorance about our needs. So if there's a lot of ignorance amongst, you know, providers and organizations, then surely we ourselves may not know what we need.
You are insightful. I enjoy it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. And that's all we have for you guys today. So I will put Lindsay's information in the description of this episode, and I will see you again, I'm sure. Yeah.
Right. Thank you.
All right. And we're done. Yay!
Yay!